I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In addition to the sorrow at the images coming out of Chile, there's also a question. Something going on? The biggest earthquake on record was also in Chile in 1960. It was 9.5 on the Richter scale. Saturday's quake there was a massive 8.8 magnitude, but it comes just weeks after the quake in Haiti. There is an earthquake every 30 seconds somewhere in the world, but why so many big ones now? Dr. John Ebel is director of the Geophysical Research Lab, the Weston Observatory at Boston College. Dr. Ebel, is there something seismically going on?
Well, people want to connect up, for instance, the Haiti earthquake with the earthquake in Chile. And from a seismological point of view, there is no relationship at all. The Haiti earthquake is a once-a-month kind of earthquake. And in fact, the few hours before the earthquake in Chile, there was a magnitude 7.0 earthquake in the Ryukyu Islands, which are north of Japan. And so a magnitude 7 is a once-a-month earthquake. What's interesting to seismologists, obviously, is this magnitude 8.8 that occurred off of Chile, because it connects up with the 1960 earthquake, which was magnitude 9.5, and suggests that very, very major earthquakes can happen along the west coast of South America.
Well, let's talk more about how earthquakes might be connected. Marcia McNutt, director of the U.S. Geological Survey, talks about 50-year cycles of activity and says earthquakes are not uniformly distributed in time, but that they cluster. So are we in a cluster, or are you talking more about a cycle in the Chilean region?
Well, the question is, are we in a cluster, is one that seismologists are very interested in paying attention to. What we know is that the truly profound earthquakes that happen on the Earth, the magnitude 8.8, 9.0, 9.2, 9.5 earthquakes, we had a series of those from 1946, roughly, to 1964. The 64 earthquake was obviously the great Good Friday earthquake that happened in Alaska and affected Anchorage and other cities. And then from 1964 to 2004, so we had a span of 40 years, we had no truly profound earthquakes like this on the Earth. And in 2004, we had the major earthquake in Indonesia. There was an 8.7 earthquake that happened also in Indonesia in 2005. And now we have this 8.8 earthquake happening in 2010. So the question for seismologists is, are we into another cycle like we had in the 40s to 1964? We don't know, but we're looking and trying to understand if maybe more of these major earthquakes might be able to occur.
Well, and what does that mean if we are in a cluster?
Well, if we are in a cluster, the places that are most prone to major earthquakes are along the west coast of South and North America, along the Aleutian Islands, along the Kurile Islands, the Japanese Islands, the Philippine Islands. Those are the places where we would continue to watch. Also, Indonesia would be another place that we would continue to watch.
Well, and as you watch, do you think the U.S. is prepared for these big earthquakes? We read that Oregon and Washington State recently undertook some earthquake preparations, retrofitting school buildings, bridges, and emergency facilities. We know we have an old infrastructure, so is it possible to get prepared if you're in a cluster, and do you think the U.S. is?
Are we prepared? Well, we're not as prepared as we would like to be. Certainly there are old structures in all parts of the United States and particularly the Pacific Northwest that we worry about. Every year we get more prepared, and we kind of hope that the earthquake is not going to happen tomorrow. On the other hand, we can't tear down every building that's not earthquake resistant and replace it tomorrow. That's just too expensive and too impractical. So we have to hope that luck is on our side even as we prepare.
And is there any way to predict an earthquake? Is there any way to sort of see some rumblings or see something playing out on a screen somewhere where there could be earthquake warnings?
The big problem we have with earthquake prediction is so far we have not seen any indicator that consistently happens immediately before strong earthquakes. Sometimes there are small earthquakes, sometimes there are not. People have reported magnetic fields or electrical fields before strong earthquakes, but that doesn't happen all the time. So right now we have no way to predict when earthquakes are coming over a short time period. Over a long time period, 10, 20, 30, 50 years, we certainly can identify those areas that are most prone to having strong earthquakes. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a good idea about where those will happen.
Well, and can you predict that earthquakes will trigger other earthquakes?
When we've had major earthquakes in the past, we've not seen major upticks in earthquake activity in other parts of the world. So I would not expect that after this earthquake.
Except, as you say, it might indicate that we are in a cluster, in which case you might get another big one in that cluster.
Well, it might indicate we're in a cluster, but short scales on geologic times are decades.
Right. Dr. John Ebel, director of the Western Observatory at Boston College, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
On President Obama's desk today, options for a new nuclear weapons policy for the U.S., part of the Nuclear Posture Review, something all presidents undertake to bring U.S. policy in line with global concerns. Senior aides quoted in the New York Times say that the president wants to permanently reduce America's nuclear arsenal by thousands of weapons, to abandon Bush-era plans for a new line of weapons called the Bunker Busters. And the BBC reports that while some in his administration want wording that the sole purpose of the use of nuclear weapons would be to prevent attack, others are pushing to not rule out the possibility of first strike. Well, right on cue, conservative Rick Moran of the website Right Wing Nut House, he writes in the American Thinker that what Obama is doing is disarmament, even if the administration won't call it that. Moran writes, "I'd love to play poker with this guy. He likes to surrender advantages without getting anything in return." We've gotten used to this kind of partisan approach to security policy from both sides of the aisle. Whatever happened to that dusty old phrase, politics stops at the water's edge? It was spoken by a Republican prior to World War II. It was supposed to symbolize cooperation and civility in national security. Well, historian Julian Zelicher says that water's edge thing is pretty much a myth. Julian is a professor at Princeton University. His new, very big book is Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. And we've invited Julian in to take a look at the news today, but also the news from the past. Julian, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And remind us, just tell us that little story. Who spoke those water's edge words?
That was said by Michigan Senator Arthur Vandenberg, who had been an isolationist in the 30s and switched after World War II. He had been an ally of President Truman in 1947 and 48 and helped him pass a lot of the national security system that we had during the Cold War.
And he actually
says that in 1952, which is ironic because that's the same year Republicans are attacking Democrats in the campaign for being weak on communism and for getting the country into a stalemate in Korea.
Well, and his point was, when it comes to wartime, that's the water's edge and politics should stop there. And you remind us, too, that prior to World War II, it was the Democrats who were thought of as the war party. But just, we want to take a look at history, but just to today's news, what are you seeing there? How does President Obama's reported decision to both reduce the nuclear arsenal and perhaps refuse to pledge not to use nuclear weapons first, what do you see happening there politically?
Well, I think the statement itself is an effort to overcome some of the problems he's had after the Christmas bombing effort and the accusations that the administration hasn't laid out what it's about. It's been defensive against Republican attacks from former Vice President Cheney onward. So I think on nuclear policy and nuclear disarmament, that's one area the president feels a little more confident. But as we've seen, the response is quite predictable. Republicans are drawing on standard rhetoric about being weak on defense.
Well, and as you point out in your book, over and over and over again, the storyline that we've come to embrace, that the GOP is strong on defense, that Democrats are weak, it has a history, a long one, but it's complicated. Can you just tick through some of the places where, in fact, that didn't hold true?
Well, absolutely. I mean, one idea is that Republicans are always hawkish, and that's true on the campaign trail. But when they are in the White House, Republicans are often the doves, so to speak. Dwight Eisenhower pursued peace agreements with the Soviet Union. Richard Nixon, who was a hawkish hawk, famously as president, pursued detente with the Soviet Union, meaning easing relations with the Soviet Union in a famous trip to China. And Ronald Reagan ended his presidency trying to negotiate an arms agreement, which he did with the Soviet Union. So there are times when Republicans act very differently than they sound on the campaign trail. And there are many times when Democrats were, in fact, the more hawkish party. After World War II, it's FDR that led the nation to a decisive victory. And during the 1950s, it's Democrats who attacked Dwight Eisenhower for being too timid on defense and for not spending enough on the military.
Let's talk a little bit about that. This is when Democrats compared the successful Russian launch of the Sputnik satellite in 1957 to Pearl Harbor, you know, and accused the Republicans of not being ready for that kind of weaponry.
Yes, there's a group of Democrats starting in 1954, Stuart Symington, a senator from Missouri, John F. Kennedy from Massachusetts, and Henry Scoop Jackson, a senator from Washington, known as the senator from Boeing because of the location of that company in his state, who attack Eisenhower. They say he's a fiscal conservative, he's trying to balance the budget, and he's trying to cut defense. And they say what the result is the Soviets are advancing in missile technology. So when Sputnik happens, they all say, look, you see, Lyndon Johnson says it's comparable to Pearl Harbor. And they develop what's called the missile gap debate that Kennedy uses in 1960 to undercut Richard Nixon, the former vice president, on national security.
I mean, it's quite an image you remind us of, John F. Kennedy running as a Cold War hawk against Richard Nixon.
Absolutely. And so this is a period when Democrats are often to the right on national security questions. And you can find this even in recent history. In the mid-1990s, President Clinton was out front on a series of national security issues, including counterterrorism after Oklahoma City and bombing Bosnia and then Kosovo, when many Republicans were the one who were ambivalent about using military force or expanding government to protect national security on the home front.
This is Princeton University historian and friend of Here and Now, Julian Zelitzer. His new book is Arsenal of Democracy, Charting the Way Political Partisanship Shapes American Foreign Policy. We got a couple minutes to the break. We want to touch down on some more times in history, but what overall are you saying, Julian? Are you saying that there was a time when national security was strictly about what was best for the country and now it's about what's best for the party?
No, I think it's always been about both, meaning there's always policymakers and politicians who are genuinely concerned about what they need to do and what's best for this country. But they always, always make those decisions in very heated political environments. And there's never some kind of mythic time that I could find when those political concerns faded away.
And there was a distinct change, well, in a couple of places in history, after World War II and then, of course, after Vietnam.
Absolutely. Look, after World War II, for the Democrats, it's a politically important war, in addition to the obvious national security issues, in that Democrats put together a very effective coalition to lead the nation into that war and to score a decisive victory. Vietnam is the opposite. Lyndon Johnson is terrified about attacks that he's weak on defense, and he's terrified of attacks from Republicans, and he accelerates the war in Vietnam to show that he's not weak, and it has disastrous results.
Again, Julian Zelitzer, his new book, Arsenal of Democracy. When we come back, we'll just delve into the Cuban Missile Crisis. Fascinated story about, maybe it was as much about domestic politics as about a Soviet threat. That'll be in about 1 minute. And later today, don't forget, we're going to take a trip to that special effects production house behind Avatar. That's later. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're checking in today with historian Julian Zelitzer. His new book is Arsenal of Democracy, How Partisan Politics Have Shaped American National Security Policy. And Julian, you pose four questions in the book. Does Congress or the President drive national security policy? How big do we want our government to be? Should the U.S. go it alone? These are all questions that both parties at different times consider and are on different sides of in the answers, actually, in different times in history. But there's one question that seems to, you know, the book seems to come down on, most importantly, do Democrats or Republicans, which party holds the national security advantage? Say again what your conclusion is.
Again, I don't have a conclusion that one party holds that advantage.
Right.
It's been very dynamic. And what I saw in the history of these 60-plus years is how this flips. There are certain times when conservatives, even since Reagan, have gotten tripped up on national security. And there's many times when Democrats are, in fact, the ones who do quite well on this issue. So neither party has a lock on it. And, in fact, that's probably what makes this even more heated than we remember, because neither party can feel secure that they're the party that voters will turn to.
Well, in fact, just Reagan, for a second, came in, you know, a huge hawk and ended up what?
He ends up negotiating an agreement with the Soviet Union, the exact thing he spent most of his career railing against. And conservatives are not happy with Ronald Reagan when he starts to talk to Gorbachev. There's one conservative activist who calls him a dupe of the Kremlin. Another compares him to Neville Chamberlain. And there are senators like Dan Quayle of Indiana who are determined not to ratify the treaty that he agrees to with Gorbachev. So Reagan actually has to work against conservatives who are criticizing him for literally being a hypocrite.
Well, in fact, do you make the point, the case that Republicans may have made sort of a devil's pact with the conservative, more hawkish wing of the party?
Absolutely. I mean, there's all this talk during the Bush years about big government conservatism and this shift in the conservative movement to ultimately embrace a strong federal government. I think that starts all the way back in the late 40s. It's kind of a devil's bargain. As conservatism is forming and the Republicans are trying to rebuild the party, they essentially accept that government has to be strong on national security questions. And there you have the seeds of big government conservatism planted. And I think it's been a contradiction ever since.
Before the break, I mentioned we'd just take a quick look at the Cuban Missile Crisis. You show us how it's in a different light than some might have perceived it. Some might think of it as kind of a heroic standoff between the U.S., Kennedy as president, Russians who are placing missiles in Cuba. But you say that, in fact, Kennedy was driven also by politics. He was accused by Republicans of ignoring the real evidence of a Soviet buildup. In my reading, it seems that maybe the Democrats did miss some of that, you tell me, and that he was trying not only to deal with the Soviets but disarm his Republican critics.
Yeah, what we forget in that famous story is that in the summer of 1962, before October, when the crisis usually starts in our stories, Republicans are attacking President Kennedy for failing to do anything about a Soviet buildup of military installations in Cuba. Senator Ken Keating of New York and Senator Homer Capehart of Indiana are leveling this charge, as are Barry Goldwater and others. And in fact, the very day that Kennedy sees the famous pictures of the installations, the Republican National Committee calls Cuba a symbol of the tragic irresolution of the administration, and they're going to use this in the midterm campaign. So Kennedy has to contend with this intense political pressure from Republicans saying, look, he was wrong. We have been warning about this, and he was wrong.
Well, but what's the lesson from that? Because he didn't, in order to sort of, you know, win over conservatives or hawks or prove how tough he could be, he didn't attack.
Absolutely. I mean, if Lyndon Johnson is the lesson in my book about, you know, what can go wrong when you give in to political pressures, as happens with Vietnam, Kennedy is the opposite. In that particular case, he is able to resist very strong political temptations and fears about what this issue is going to do with him. And he doesn't act according to those political interests. So it is still a heroic story. But in some ways, it's even more interesting once we remember the really intense political attacks he faced.
Well, so where does this all leave us, Julian? Again, a huge read in his new book, Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. We've only touched on just a bit of it, but we started by saying that the idea once was, briefly, before World War II, that politics stops at the water's edge. You end the book by quoting from Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's op-ed in the New York Times in 2007. It was entitled, Politics Starts at the Water's Edge. The opposite of stops. What was she saying? What are you saying? What can legislators learn today?
Well, I do think to start with the premise that somehow the politics will go away is a mistake. And what we see throughout the history is that, you know, once politicians accept this and they create political strategies to sell their national security programs and to respond to the kind of attacks that are inevitably coming, that can often help them make better policy. Again, it's not about making policy based on political interests, but treating this as an issue that will be part of political debate.
That was her point.
Yeah. Absolutely. And she says that explains part of Ronald Reagan's success. And I think it's just a reality, whether we like it or not, that presidents and legislators have to contend with.
Well, and just briefly, we only have a few seconds, but how is that tension that maybe has gotten, I don't know, more, has increased now, how is that spilling over into things like healthcare? Is it?
It is. Look, I think you always had partisanship, but now we have partisanship on steroids. I think the moderates have almost totally disappeared from both parties. So whether you're talking about health care or counterterrorism, there's fewer moments of bipartisanship, which there were before. And then it's kind of a totally difficult environment for legislating.
So how to use it for the better of the country,
yes,
since it's there. Princeton historian Julian Zelitzer. Again, his book, Arsenal of Democracy, everything you ever wanted to know about politics and national security. Julian, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow in Here and Now, a round of records. We're going to hear some terrific music. They're marking 40 years in the business. We'll look at the label that helped launch George Thorogood, but also Alison Krauss. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, the going rate for a provincial governor's job in Afghanistan is about, $200,000. Why so high? Well, it has something to do with development dollars, as we'll hear. But the latest news is next, Here and Now. It's cuss-free week in California. Today, the state Senate designates this first week of March a time to watch your mouth. It's not an enforceable law, just a symbolic resolution with cuss jars delivered to state lawmakers, maybe like your grandma used to do. And it would seem like a pretty harmless idea, but the 16-year-old behind it has received death threats. McKay Hatch, joins us today from South Pasadena, California. McKay, well, first of all, happy cuss-free week.
Oh, thank you.
You must be pretty happy because you started a high school no-cussing club about 3 years ago. It's grown to a website with 35,000 members worldwide. But what started it all? I mean, was it really that bad, or was it, maybe the word damn or H-E double hockey sticks?
Well, what ended up happening is my friends started cussing in middle school. I mean, they never did it in elementary school. They were using, the worst word you can use. I mean, it wasn't like something when they stubbed their toe. It was like every other word they were saying it. So I said, I don't like those words you're using. Could you please use a little bit better language around me? And I was like, great, I just lost all my friends. But actually, they were pretty cool about it, and they said they weren't going to cuss around me anymore.
Well, it grew from there. You've written a book. You've created a curriculum. What were you feeling you were seeing about cursing in a broader sense?
I think a lot of people were saying during this whole thing, words don't have any meaning. I mean, why are you even doing this? Well, the words you say, have a lot of power. I mean, they affect nations, Martin Luther King, the things he said. And actually, a school in Louisiana just did a 2-year study after implementing the No Cussing Club, and they found that they had a 64% decrease in profanity and a 90% decrease in bullying. Know it or not, this No Cussing Club is making a difference.
So you saw a connection between words people used and then actions they took, physical violence even, or bullying.
Yeah, your words, lead to your actions become your behavior becomes your character, and your character becomes your destiny. You are what you speak, and your words have a lot of power.
Well, your destiny seems to have put you right in the crosshairs of some bullies, and you started getting phone calls, your website got hacked into, you got a death threat?
Yeah, on January 4th, we received 60,000 emails of death threats and people saying they're going to come over to my house and, kill us and hurt our family, and it was kind of scary at first, but then, I realized after a while these are just bullies and they want you to be scared, and, I wasn't going to be scared.
Someone sent prostitutes to your home?
Yeah, and we had taxis, and we had over $2,000 worth of pizza sent to our house, and at first that sounds good, but we had to pay for it, and we didn't, obviously, and so the managers were getting angry at us. So.
Well, this got pretty serious pretty quickly, and I'm just wondering, you're sort of from a family that's used to taking a stand. Your parents wrote a book called Raising a G-Rated Family in an X-Rated World. You're all Mormon. You have very strict values. But what do you think about people who are wondering, in online blogs, whether or not your parents are pushing their beliefs through you onto others? I mean, isn't it sort of trying to, remake the world to your values?
I mean, that's what a lot of people think. I mean, they think, your dad and your mom and dad started a club, and I wouldn't never have taken this club this far. I mean, it's funny, when I first started the club, my dad was totally against it. He said, why would you even start this club? Because he knew I was going to be bullied and people getting angry at me, which I was. But, they're really not pushing anything on me. They totally left it up to me. And but now, my dad's my biggest supporter, and so it was totally my idea.
And you have no problem with sort of expressing what you think would be a valuable value for others.
Yeah, I have no problem.
Well, one last question to you, McKay Hatch. I'm wondering if you've heard from the governor of California. It's been reported that about 4 months ago, he sent out an acrostic and a veto message. An acrostic is a poem where the first letter of every line ultimately spells out a word, and in his, it spelled out, a phrase that begins with F and ends with Y-O-U. He says it was just a coincidence. Have you heard from him or you have thoughts on a governor possibly doing that?
I mean, that's really, you know, disappointing because, you know, he really sets the example. So I'm really kind of disappointed that he would do something like that. But I haven't really talked to him or said anything, but I'm just really kind of disappointed.
Well, instead, you've gotten No Cuss Week, which begins today. McKay Hatch in California, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Cool, thank you.
And that is McKay Hatch singing his Don't Cuss song. You can check out his No Cussing Club and anti-bullying curriculum at our website, hereandnow.org. And, of course, while there, we'd love to hear your thoughts on anything on the program. You just click on Contact Us to send an email or scroll down and leave a comment. No cuss. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. Don't cuss. My dad was watching news. I was trying to chill. The U.S. has poured $38 billion in development funds into Afghanistan since the war there began. But how much of that money is ending up in the hands of the very insurgents targeting Americans? As one sergeant concludes, we're financing our own enemy. Part of the problem, money's hard to track, especially when the U.S. often pays Afghan contractors with big bags of cash. Here's Army Deputy Commander Colonel Sindra Chastain.
The contractor came to the front gate, and our pay agent met him at the gate with a garbage bag of $2.4 million Afghani money in a garbage bag and gave it to him. He signed for it, but gave it to him.
$2.4 million Afghanis, that's about $50,000 US. Independent journalist Douglas Wissing went to the Taliban stronghold of Host Province in southeastern Afghanistan to investigate corruption there, and he joins us now. Doug, we've heard for years that Americans used cash to pay for things in Iraq and Afghanistan, but why is so much money still being paid out in cash?
Firstly, there was virtually no Afghan banking system. So the capacity to be able to pay somebody with a check or with an electronic transfer was pretty much nil up to recently. The U.S. forces are really pushing to increase electronic transfers so that we keep the cash off the battlefield, is the term that's often used, where when there's just cash floating around, it's very easy for it to get into the hands of insurgents or to get places where it wasn't supposed to go. The downside of that, of course, is that the banking system is basically controlled by the most powerful families in Afghanistan, and in some cases they're hiring Taliban to be the security people, or they're paying the Taliban not to attack various sites. I spent some time working with a group called the Afghan Threat Finance Cell, and they're trying to look at what are the sources of threat funding and then how do we attack it. And one of the problems with the primary way that money moves around in Afghanistan, which is the hawala system, is a very informal system that goes throughout the Islamic world to transfer money all over the place. It's extremely efficient. It's extremely inexpensive in comparison to international banking. It is virtually paperless. It's really tough to track stuff.
By the way, how does the hawala system work? Is it just word of mouth, or somebody keeps numbers in their head?
Well, there is some paperwork, but it's very simple by comparison to the international banking system, and it's often run through money changers. One of the officials from the embassy was telling me they were sort of running a test with the hawala system. So they had an Afghan go in with $100,000 into one of the money changers in Afghanistan and wanted it transferred to New York, where someone was supposed to come and pick up the money. He said it was hilarious. Half an hour later, the hawala in New York was calling the contact person saying, when are you going to come and get this money? You know, it was almost instantaneous.
Why would somebody send $100,000 from Afghanistan to New York?
Let's say you had just skimmed a whole bunch of money out of a development contract and you'd wanted to get it out of the country.
Well,
but most
go.
Likely it wouldn't go to New York. It would go to Dubai. That's where a lot of this gets parked.
Well, you spoke to Colonel Brian Copes about making sure money doesn't go to the Taliban and how transparent Afghans can be about the problems. Let's listen.
I probably had a dozen of the Afghan leaders here candidly say as we're talking, you should not even trust me. Don't give me the money, or don't give me the money, I wouldn't give it to my employees. I mean, they just ever so matter-of-factly say, you should not even trust me.
Well, in the face of that, Doug, what do people like Colonel Copes do?
They try to monitor the money. They just try to watch it. And having said that, at some point, they also shrug their shoulders. They don't know. Things become opaque at a certain point. You hire an Afghan contractor. He, in turn, hires subcontractors. That subcontractor most often hires other subcontractors. And things happen behind veils.
But what is the thinking of the Americans? Is, you know, that they continue to do this in places where they can't do wire transfers. They continue to give out cash. Because why? I mean, if it works well, it sounds as if the contractor then turns around and hires Afghans who otherwise would go up and pick up a gun for the Taliban.
We have to remember that development is an essential part of our counterinsurgency strategy. The theory is that if we do development, it does pull people and bind them to the government of Afghanistan. They sort of know that they're going to break some eggs to make an omelet, and they're willing to accept that. They're looking for as many strategies as they can to try to reduce the flow of development dollars into insurgent hands. But I tend to feel like it's at the early stages. I mean, we don't have a banking system there in place, so they can track the money. They're trying to go after the Hawala system and then mine cell phone numbers and the standard, investigating techniques. But everybody's just starting to get their hands around the problem as best I can see.
Another part of the problem, corruption in Afghanistan, has to do with Afghanis paying for posh government positions. Here's Colonel Brian Copes again speaking to you about that.
I had heard early on that it was $200,000 was the going rate if you wish to be a provincial governor. If you can buy your way into a governmental position, it's an investment. And then you are going to find ways to benefit or to draw a return on that investment.
It is a systemic system of corruption. Everybody from the cop on the beat to the police chief up to the provincial governors and then going upstream to Kabul, everybody's in on the take. If you need to send your kid to school, you got to pay. And to a certain extent, it's the way it is, but it's been put on steroids with this massive amount of money that's flowed through the system from us. And actually, just the other day, I was speaking with a former USDA official who worked in Afghanistan, and he was saying, oh, actually, Host is pretty cheap. Host is a pretty poor province. He said, other provinces, to get a governor, you have to pay $1 million. I was recently told by an embassy official that corruption has spiked since Obama announced his plans to start getting troops out in 12 to 18 months because the people who were corrupt feel like the spigot might get turned off. The people that weren't corrupt now feel like they've got to grab money to be able to exit the country because it's going to collapse after we leave. It's part of what goes on out there. There's sort of hell if you do and hell if you don't.
Well, in fact, Doug, you quote an incredibly cynical captain, Douglas Seymour, as you say, a massive lantern-jawed cop from Las Vegas who's serving as an intelligence officer.
Yeah, I mean, he said something like, the government here, they're like the mafia. They're always getting their cut. The Taliban, they always get their cut. It's the perfect war. Everybody makes money.
Well, that is pretty jaded.
That's part of what goes on out there. You have a lot of people working incredibly hard, including Doug Seymour, trying to really do a really tough job. But we're dealing with a lot of really difficult issues.
Doug Wissing, again, an independent journalist with his observations about corruption in Afghanistan. Doug, thanks so much, as always.
Thank you.
Okay, before we go today, the people behind Avatar's animation and special effects, and later on this week, director Jonathan Demme. But right now, we'll take a quick break. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. A quick note, let the late night wars begin again. Tonight, Jay Leno is back as host of The Tonight Show, again going head-to-head with David Letterman. If you're following at home, NBC canceled Leno's primetime show after low ratings. His return to late night meant Conan O'Brien had to go to later night. Instead, he walked out the door. As to the shows that remain, it looks like conservatives are the hot get in late-night booking. This week, Leno has Sarah Palin, also Jamie Foxx, gold medal skier Lindsey Vonn, and the cast of Jersey Shore, oh, to be in that green room. Letterman has booked former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, also comedian Jerry Seinfeld, and newsman Tom Brokaw. As for Conan, he's reportedly working on a deal with Fox and in the meantime is tweeting. So far, he's interviewed a squirrel in his backyard, and over the weekend he wrote, "This is only my fifth tweet, and I'm already exhausted. My God, how does Ashton Kutcher do it?"
Ladies and gentlemen, you are not in Kansas anymore. You are on Pandora.
Sound from James Cameron's groundbreaking sci-fi fantasy Avatar. It's that time of year, the Olympics behind us, the Oscars ahead, Sunday in fact. And Avatar may be the first film ever to win the Best Picture Oscar that was written and conceived before the technology existed to make it. Glenn Zorpet from IEEE Spectrum Radio visited the place where all that magic happened, Weta Digital, the state-of-the-art special effects lab in New Zealand, co-founded by director Peter Jackson and named after the giant insects that roam that island nation.
"To become Aronyu, hunter, you must choose your own Ikran, and he must choose you."
"When?"
"When you are ready."
To understand the leap in visual technology Avatar brings to your movie screen, Sebastian Silwan says it's useful to look back at the dark ages of special effects, even if they were just a few short years ago.
"In traditional visual effects, if you were to go into a jungle, you would either stylize it a lot, or you would make live-action plates of the plants and the complexity of the jungle itself, and then put your visual effects or your characters on in front of it."
But director James Cameron told Silwan, who heads R&D at Weta, that for Avatar, he wanted something that had never been done before.
"He basically was asking to have aliens or characters that you could completely emote with, and you would have the performance of the actors that performed the lines come through in a different character with a different face, of course, in an alien that is 10 foot tall."
"Looks like you. This is your avatar now, Jake."
Silwan is an amiable Argentinian with a wild mane of shoulder-length sandy brown hair. His job is to oversee the creative ferment that bubbles among the banks of servers at Weta, servers that access 3 million gigabytes of memory, enough memory and computing power to take Silwan and his effects teams at Weta where few engineers had gone before, across something called the Uncanny Valley. It's an old term borrowed from the world of artificial intelligence.
"There is a principle, a well-known principle, that you can increase the level of realism that is perceived in a human-like expression. And as the level of realism increases, the level of perceived realism increases as well. There is a point, though, where we get too close to humans, but not close enough. And we start being creeped out by that. And so the level of perceived realism drops."
In other words, the closer you get to realism, the harder it gets to, well, get any closer, to cross that uncanny valley.
"Only in the last few years there have been examples of humans, of digital humans, that have crossed that valley for the first time."
"They stole it from us, my precious."
Silwan says Gollum, the digitally deformed hobbit in Peter Jackson's The Lord of the Rings, was likely the first movie character to cross the uncanny valley. Then came Brad Pitt, the first A-list actor, you might say, to win an Oscar for visual effects as the age-bending Benjamin Button.
"How old are you?"
"7, but I look a lot older."
"God bless you. He's 7.
To portray convincing emotion on the faces of Avatar's digital creatures, Silwan says his software specialist had to map the motion of the real actors' faces to their corresponding digital stand-ins. To make that happen, Silwan says Weta teamed up with another effects company called Lightstorm to create a head-mounted camera that tracked painted dots on the faces of the human actors.
"There was a software that in real time was able to transfer the tracking of those points of certain points on the face and bring them onto a character that was the character that the actor was performing for. And the director was able to see not only the body movements that were captured by the cameras in the volume, but also the facial expressions that were performed in front of this camera.
Another special effects advance in Avatar is in the way light is portrayed. In earlier computer animation, think Toy Story, light appears to just bounce off objects. But Weta researcher Luca Fascione says that's not how light behaves in the real world.
You think an ear, for example. In the when somebody's lit from the back, you can see their ears go very bright red. And so that happens because light enters from the back of the ear, goes through the ear itself, and comes out at the front. In Avatar, what happens is that light actually enters in the volume of the flesh and then starts going in all possible directions and picks up all the colors of the materials that it traverses while going from point A to point B.
To see that lighting technique in all its glory, Fascione says look no further than the pivotal scene in which the hero, Jake, is lost in the woods and is being stalked by the heroine, Neytiri, who ultimately decides not to kill him.
The lighting patterns on her face are all broken up by because there's shadows from leaves. And you can see how on the borders of her nose or on her ears, you can see all this little shadowing and lighting effects. Lights coming from behind, lights coming from the front.
Avatar introduced other breakthroughs, too. Like the software Weta designed to flawlessly lip-sync the dialogue spoken by the Na'vi characters to the facial movements of the actors who played them. For Silwan, these technical advances were a dream come true. He was just 7 when his passion for movie effects took hold, sitting in a theater in Argentina, awestruck by Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Now, Silwan finds himself supervising special effects teams for Spielberg's latest film, The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn. It's due for release next year, and Silwan says, like Avatar, Tintin will also stake out new territory.
We are always trying to push the envelope, right? And working with such directors as James Cameron, Steven Spielberg, or Peter Jackson, there is never a known path that we're going to go through. It's always trying to push the boundaries of what can be delivered and how a better story can be told.
Oh my God.
Faces. For more on Weta Digital and its role in the making of Avatar, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Our story was produced by Glenn Zorpet for IEEE Spectrum, the magazine for technology insiders. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us to see what the week brings. Here and Now.